The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kappas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. So I decided to talk about grief today, and especially what's called the Great Grief, or the Kokoro Konoshiku, which is a Japanese word. River Master Jiyu used to talk about the Great Grief to the monks. I don't know if she talked about it to the lay people as well. But I think the Great Grief has many aspects, and part of it is the grief inherent in all existence, the grief of the suffering of the world that we can't do anything about. This is the world of samsara. This is the world of suffering. And the Buddha taught that there is suffering and that there is the cessation of suffering. And we can do something about ourselves. We can do something about our own suffering. And we can help beings along the way. But we can't help the suffering of other beings. We can't take away the suffering in the world. It seemed fitting to talk about this at this time because of all the things that are going on in the world that are painful to see. All the anger and the confusion and the killings and then the repercussions and on and on and on. And it can be difficult to bear this suffering. And we can become either hardened to it or turn away or just overwhelmed by it. But we don't have to be. And I'm going to actually read a lot from River Master Jiyu, so I hope you'll bear with me with all my readings. But I had an idea of what I wanted to talk about, and then I had to look for it. And it took me days to find what I was looking for. And one journal article, it just really took a long time. And finally, in the end, with the kind help of Reverend Vera, I found that article. So I'm gonna read that. I didn't know the name, which made it difficult, but I knew what it was about. But anyway, I found everything I was looking for. Well, not quite everything, but I found enough. So so this is starting out a little grim. You know, there's a lot of suffering, and we can't do anything about it. However, it's not going to end grim. Although the Buddha taught and found the cessation of suffering, he was still a human being, and he felt grief. I'm sure it was more than this, but the two incidents I can think about are when his two chief disciples died, Mahamogayana and Shariputra, whom he was very close to, and he grieved a lot over their death and their loss and missed them. And also, I think maybe, I don't know if it was toward the end of his life, but it certainly wasn't at the early part of his teaching, when his own clan, the Shakya clan, kept fighting with another clan, a neighboring clan. I think it was over water rights, I'm not quite sure. And he kept trying to stop it, you know, with his powers. He kept going when they were about to fight, and would he would be there, and it wouldn't happen. But finally he realized that this was going to have to work itself out, and he couldn't do a thing about it. So he had to watch while his family and relatives were killing each other, killing the neighboring tribe, and that must have been a great grief for him, part of that great grief, to see it and know he had to just let it work itself out. But he was not overwhelmed by it. And that is the difference between people who are training and some people who are not, that you can become overwhelmed by either your own grief, grief of those you love, grief of the world. It can become overwhelming, and we can feel like we could sink into it if we went into it completely. Reverend Master Jihyu also felt grief. I remember one incident when her cat died, and I was the organist at that time, and she came in for the animal's funeral, and she was crying, and I was very moved by it. But again, there was a stillness there, and it was okay. So there's not a problem feeling grief. It's fine. She also talks about it in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, when she was having this deep religious experience, and some of her monks turned away. And were actually, you know, thought she was messing up the teaching. And this is what she says. There have been those in these last few weeks who have been horrified by what I have told them. There have been those who have sworn that I am ruining the teaching. Those who have gone away. How sad I am for them. For days and days I grieved until my sickness came back. And then I went again into meditation, even deeper than ever before. So for those of you who haven't read How to Grow a Lotus Blossom, she becomes very ill, and then she goes very deeply into meditation. Grieving over the loss of these, I ask the Lord deeply, what is the mistake I have made? What harm I have done? Please show me if I have done harm, for indeed I intend none. Well, some of this you won't understand, but I'll read it anyway. And we were told that the answer was to be found in the five branches of the diamond scepter, the five columns of light, and I knew that it was within the second column. For the Lord indeed does take care of all his beings. It is not from, and this is an important part, we are not God, and we cannot change other people. But the Lord of the house, that which is, does not ever turn away from anyone. For the Lord indeed does take care of all his beings. It is not for me to usurp the place of the Lord. That they go or come is not my problem. That they stay is not my problem. If they turn away from me, the Lord still does not turn away from them. If I feel anguish at their loss, it is because there is in me still some clinging, and herein lies the use of the second column, the washing in eternal love. I offer up both them and me into this column. I watch them washed within this luminescent water of the Spirit. The Lord neither rejects anything nor holds on to it. He washes, he cleanses, he loves, and he waits. So thus should we do also with all fear, offer it up to the Lord in the second column, watch it washed and cleansed. We need nothing more to cleanse us from the Vasana than our own willingness to offer it to the Lord and to love it and not reject it as he does as we pass it on. His love indeed will cleanse all things. There is no need for any assistance for another being such as I. And we saw a film recently, a documentary. I don't know how recently. My memory doesn't remember that kind of thing anymore. But it was on D.T. Suzuki's life. And for those of you who don't know D.T. Suzuki, he was a devout lay Buddhist. He wasn't a monk. And he wrote numerous books on Buddhism. And he's somebody that Reverend Master met in England. And he talked about his experiences. He'd had some religious experiences, and he talked openly about them. And there were these people interviewing him. Some of it was quite funny, actually, some of the questions they asked. But at any rate, they asked him how he felt at the death of his wife, whom he was very close to. And he said he grieved deeply. And the person who was interviewing him said, well, what was the point of your experience if you're still grieving, if you still know suffering, if you still grieve? And he said, the difference is, and I can't remember the exact words, but it's similar to what Reverend Master was talking about. He was held up by something. So he didn't sink into the grief. He was held up and it was okay. And I think what these examples are teaching us is that as human beings, we will always feel grief. We will always feel suffering, the suffering of others. But there is something more, and that's what will hold us up, and that's what's important. And if we feel overwhelmed by the suffering of the world, we don't have to despair. We don't have to get angry. What we can do is turn within, because it's within ourselves that we find the Buddha. And we find something much deeper that can handle whatever suffering there is, and something that goes deeper than the suffering of the world. So instead of despairing, instead of getting angry, which only increases our suffering and doesn't help the world at all, we can continue our training in faith and trust. And that will not only help us, but it will help the world. And I know for myself, I got caught up in this one evening after our retreat, when I decided to see what was going on. You know, we heard about the shootings in San Bernardino. And I saw this stuff, and I felt sad, and I felt kind of helpless and really annoyed, because I felt like it didn't have to be this way. You know, there could have been sanity. You know, and it wasn't just the people who did this, but, you know, before that, the things that led to it, that others contributed to. And yet, it is this way. And we have to accept it, and this is the world of ignorance, where there's a lot of people training, a lot of good people, but there's also a lot of delusion. And this is just how it is. And acceptance, not turning away, trusting, keeping up our training, this is what helps, and this is what's important. Now, there's another teaching on the Kokoro Kunoshiku, the great grief in the Wild White Goose. And it's well into it. And where she is finally fed up with all that has happened to her. And, you know, she's had a really rough time in Japan, and but she's used it for her own good. She's used it to help her find the truth by doing her training and trusting that everybody had a good heart for her. And this really helped her. And she had been planning to go back to England, but the British were now causing trouble and saying they didn't want her. And then she overheard that the Japanese really didn't want her there. So being a human being, even after having a religious experience and training deeply, she was fed up. And it all kind of came out, and she was talking to what's called the kanon, the director, or what we might call the prior here. She was his chaplain, and he was talking to her about the great grief, and I found this helpful. And I'm going to read some of what she says so that you can kind of get a sense of what was going on. I see. In other words, I was to stay here after what had happened in London without ever knowing how people really felt about me and foreigners in general. I was always to think that anti-foreign comments that I heard or thought I heard were imagined. I was to be a creature that was a cut above the Koreans because I was of use to the temple, but of whom no one could forget that I possessed two round eyes and a long nose. That is Japanese Buddhism, and I've just had some examples of British Buddhism. I find myself wondering what would happen if the Buddha were to return to the world now. I find myself wondering if there is anyone in existence who knows really what he taught. Do you realize that in forcing me to stay here, instead of letting me go to a women's monastery, you have made me the object of the jealousy of every female trainee in this country? Am I to understand that Zenji-sama, that was her teacher, wishes this so as to show the women priests their mean nature, or to show them that they are jealous? What do you think I am, a saint? Believe me, I am human, and I came here to do something about myself because I knew I was human. I did not come in order to lead and teach others, either directly or indirectly, as a result of being a sort of guinea pig, to show others their faults. It seems that I am to be an eternal mirror monk, but that job isn't forced on anyone else here. He sighed. Long ago I taught you the Sando Kai. With the ideal comes the actual, like a box and its lid. It seems you are still, to a certain extent, stuck with the ideal. And I think this can happen to people after they've had a religious experience, that they see the purity and perhaps they want the world to be so. You must know that it exists. Of course you know that it exists. If you don't, you can never understand true Buddhism. As I told you a long time ago, however, understanding, enlightenment, whatever you like to call it, does not bring happiness. Only the Kokoro Kanashiku, the great grief, out of which comes the all-embracing, all-acceptance, and selfless love of Shakyamuni Buddha, the actual, which unites it with the ideal. You must know the ideal. You must accept the actual. Only thus can you help others and yourself. Things are as they are because of the greed, hate, and delusion of the world. The only people we can do anything about are ourselves. Here in this temple, we have the opportunity of being true bodhisattvas, to be mirrors of the truth to all our fellow trainees, so that they may see that which exists within themselves is the greatest of all callings. Well, and if I go to America, how does that particular teaching help the oppressed Negroes and other minority groups there, I asked. Am I to tell them that things are as they are and that they must learn to accept them? as things are now, have they any alternative? He replied. The only certain cure for such a situation is self-knowledge, and as each of us does something about himself, so does the day of help for these unfortunate people draw nearer. We have to do something about ourselves in order to help them. They have to do something about themselves in order to help us. With the ideal comes the actual, like a box and its lid. The greatest teaching this temple can give is that of all acceptance, which is the understanding that all is one and all is different. So, all acceptance seems to be the key. And then the bell rings for meditation, or for ceremonies. The bell is ringing, you must put on your robes. When Zenji-sama dies, another will ring the bell. I have heard whisperings that the vice abbot will not want the previous abbot's disciples, I said. A bell rings according as it is struck, and we answer it in the same way. So, acceptance. We have to answer what is happening and do our training within it. When we first start meditating and training, the only suffering we may be aware of is our own. And I know that was true for me. Looking back now, I had probably hardened myself to the suffering of others and to the suffering all around me. But as we go on in training, as our suffering lessens, we can become more sensitive to the suffering of the world and to suffering of others. And I had an example of this in my own experience, well, many examples, but the one that came to mind was we had two cats here named Brandy and Alexandra, and they showed up one day in the snow, mother and daughter, and you know how sometimes some person or some animal you're just drawn to, and I was really drawn to Brandy and Alexandra, and especially Alexandra. I just loved them dearly and cared about them. And one night Alexandra didn't come home. She had been a wanderer, you know, going all over the place, and she was found the next day by the freeway fence, dead. She had been killed and partly eaten by a coyote. And I'm almost going to cry now at that memory. But I felt, you know, the grief for her death. But the thing that was most painful was her mother's grief. And her mother was looking for her and moaning and crying. And it just touched my heart. And I felt like my heart was being torn apart by her grief. But, you know, I felt it, and I didn't dwell on it. And it passed, and eventually hers passed. And now she's a very happy cat, living with the person who loves the cats the most. Well, I don't know if she does, but she loves all cats, and Brandy is very happy now. So it did pass. And sometimes we just, you know, some suffering just tweaks us, and we feel it deeply. And sometimes it's, you know, the grief of someone we love, some being that we love. Either their loss or just watching them suffer and knowing that we cannot really change it, because we can only change ourselves and offer the teaching, but we can't change them. We can't make them do the training. And beings are ready to do the training when they're ready, in whatever form it takes. It doesn't have to be Buddhist training. And until that time, There's nothing we can do about it except kindness. Kindness helps. However, although we don't turn away from the suffering of others and we may feel it, we don't become a sponge. We don't take on their suffering. That is not the training. The other person's suffering is their suffering, even if we may feel it. And it does not help either us or the other person to try and make it go away by taking it on. Even if they're trying to get us to take it on. And in your heart, you know that isn't really helpful. And as Reverend Master Jiyu talks about, and what I read, is that we aren't God. The unborn is taking care of all of us. And sometimes the suffering that others experience is what they need in order to finally turn around and do something. So don't become a sponge. So what I've talked about so far, acceptance, faith, training, continuing our training, not turning away, not giving in to our reactions, and yet another reading from Reverend Master Jiyu, and this is from Roar of the Tigress, Volume 2. It's the chapter on the great ocean of meditation, which is one of my favorite chapters in her book. Viewing the arising and vanishing of the elements from the place of meditation makes it possible to go onward, not only through the fears that arise from attachment, but also through the grief that arises in this sad world. Indeed, sometimes the world is cruel and unfair. Sometimes it's downright terrible. These things are explained by the law of karma. Karma is cold comfort. I know. I've had to live with it. But if one stays still in meditation, gradually one sees over the years that the essence is the supreme thing, that our little judgments and our little opinions do not really amount to so much as one hair on a dog's back. It's very humbling to realize how great the design of the universe is, because it is not fully comprehensible by any of us. But one can have some glimpse of the colossal size of it and of how important and benevolent it actually is. Yet all the suffering does go on an individual level, or so it seems. And so long as our faith stays true, we can help that suffering by staying within the third position. And she called the third position the place between the opposites, the place of the unborn, the truth, which really isn't a place. That does not mean that we become cold-hearted. It doesn't mean that we become non-compassionate. It doesn't mean we can't grieve. The Zen master can both grieve and cry, but his grief does not overwhelm him so that he is incapable of acting, because he himself or she is rooted in faith and meditation. And the same can be true of every monk and layperson. If you are rooted in faith and living in the third position, then when the horrors of stupidity and ignorance come, you will not be overwhelmed by the suffering. Instead, you will want to renew your own efforts, both at helping and strengthening your own faith and in helping and strengthening the faith of others. If your faith is rooted in this place, in the living meditative state that bears the seal of the ocean, then although there will be grief, although there will be pain, it will be bearable. And we will not be so caught up in the emotionalism of the moment that we do not know what to do to alleviate the pain of self and others. We will, in fact, because we are not caught up in that emotionalism, be the most effective people possible. You must accept that, whilst we remain within this body, whilst the elements coalesce together, life will be painful. What we need to know is that we can sit still beneath it. The Zen master does not offer you magic that will turn off the pain of the world. He or she does show you how you can sit still beneath that pain so that you can help the world to make itself less painful. And she certainly did a lot to make the world less painful. She used to say that, I think this is what she said, if I'm wrong, I hope someone will correct me, but that she wasn't out to save the world. If she could change herself and maybe help one other person, she would be satisfied. She was kind of giving us the scope and extent of how hard it was to change oneself, and that she couldn't really change the world, and that wasn't her intention. But because of her training, she helped numerous people to find help with their suffering and to know what to do to go in the right direction. So many of us may not know this third position. We may have stumbled on it from time to time, but aren't able to quite be there all the time. But we can trust, and this is what we have to do. We have to trust and have faith, even though we may wobble a little with our own suffering, with the suffering of others, with the suffering of the world. We can come back to faith and trust and acceptance. Well, if you can bear one more reading, this is, it's a great joy for me to read this to you because of the difficulty in finding it and the joy in finally finding it. And I knew it existed, I just didn't know the name. So it is in the November-December 1982 journal of Shasta Abbey, and it's called How to Find Kanzeon in Hell. I received, and this is Reverend Master Jiyu again, I received a letter from one of our lay members of the Sangha recently, which I felt was of such great importance that I wish to share a portion of it with you and make it the starting point of this Jukai session. The person concerned writes as follows. I do not quite know how to explain the following, but I often feel that a part of me is present at the Abbey. I can feel the ground under the cloister beneath my feet. I can see the inside of the Hondo, that's the Buddha Hall, and feel the presence there. And yet my heart feels burdened by grief and despair. The thoughts and feelings of others enter unbidden into my consciousness. I seem to see only suffering, suffering. I know I must learn to see the Buddha in all things. When I sit in Zazen, meditation, and ask for help for myself and the world, the answer seems to be the very suffering I am trying to understand. When I ask what suffering is, I see only a deep blackness shot through with golden points of light, and still I must go on. Anytime someone tries to do something about himself or herself, he will find himself burdened with other people's grief unless he knows that he is not the cosmic Buddha, and that there is nothing in him that is not of the cosmic Buddha. She used to call that, you know, the unborn, the cosmic Buddha, and then Lord of the House, the eternal, the unborn. One of the sad things for members of helping professions is that too many of them take to themselves the sufferings of others and eventually make themselves ill with it. They do not yet realize that they are not the cosmic Buddha and must ask for help from the cosmic Buddha. This person, when asking for help, is shown the suffering shot through with golden points of light, with the essence of Buddha. These times are the little moments that make one dance. One has to be willing to cry, "I am not sufficient, I cannot do it alone." This is what will make the essence of Buddha appear. What will make it possible is faith. The deeper we go into meditation, the more suffering becomes apparent, and the more important it is that our faith shall deepen and that we learn to recognize the little golden moments that point the way to the cosmic Buddha. It is important to stop trying to hold on to being able to do something by ourselves about the suffering. For if we attempt to become thus omnipotent, all we will see is suffering, and we ourselves are then in the way. And if we are in the way, we cannot see the cosmic Buddha working through it. It is a very hard lesson to learn. For a layman or laywoman, it is even harder. But all the signs are there. This person is never apart from the temple. Its presence is always felt. Perhaps she needs to know that the real temple is the temple of one's own body, and the real cloister is everywhere. We enter into a monastery, we retreat, in order to advance. If the burden of suffering is constantly hindering us, we cannot advance. If we cannot look at the suffering and see the golden fragments and recognize that they are the cosmic Buddha shining through that suffering and have faith to hold on to that, then nothing can help us. We come to Jukhai so that we may learn to keep the precepts and thereby find the Buddha, for the Buddha lies within those precepts. In finding the Buddha, we learn how to recognize the little golden moments within suffering. And thus, what was originally a dark and black and seemingly grieving and despairing place becomes the garden of the bodhisattvas, the waveless sea of the arahants, saints. We can find it before what is known as death and can know that it is so after what man calls death. The eternal is within all these situations. The eternal is within all things. The world is a rough place to those who do not know this. And we used to have a garden out here called the Kanzeon Garden, where there'd be all the different realms of existence, the hells, the hungry ghosts, the animals, the humans, all the different realms. And there was a Buddha or a Kanzeon in all those realms, showing that no matter how deep the suffering, the compassion is always there as well. To see the Buddha in suffering, in pleasure, in pain, in joy and sorrow is one of the greatest gifts of enlightenment. But faith is much needed to be able to do this. And you have to do a lot of work upon yourself before faith is a fully understood concept. Far too few people know what faith really means. In one sense, every one of us has incredible faith. We all believe we will waken in the morning, but we have no proof of it. Remember, Master Jiyu, when a monk would ask, which was often me, "I don't have any faith." She would say, "Well, you believe that you will wake up in the morning." So this was something I can relate to. We believe that we will, but one day we will not, and neither of these ideas terrify us. It is with this attitude of mind that one must go through the world and the monastery. It is absolutely imperative that we feel the cloister beneath our feet and the presence of the Hondo, the Buddha Hall, within our hearts wherever we go. then however much grief and suffering others lay upon us, simply because the person concerned is looking for a sympathetic ear, or because we happen to be more open than others and can feel it more clearly, whatever way it is, if we have found the way to carry that presence in our hearts, then whether we are here or whether we are sitting in the dining hall or working in a hospital or in a hospice or sitting in an office or driving a bus, no matter what we are doing, whatever the suffering is, that we see or that we come into, we will see the Lord's work, and we will learn to accept that this is the way it is, because this is how karma works. In accepting the karmic consequences, we will find the Lord in all things and be able to work peacefully and effectively. So I will end with that, and I hope that was helpful.